Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is Gabrielle Runyon from Louisville, Kentucky. She is a sophomore at University of Louisville, studying psychology with a double minor in Spanish and music. And she has SMA. She was also one of our contributors to the 31 Days of SMA campaign in 2020, which we were just discussing, feels like a lifetime ago because of the last years. But Gabrielle, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to talking. And before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast was brought to you by Genentech, the makers of an FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
Okay, Gabrielle, to start off, can you just give us listeners a little background on yourself? And then just to, I know in your 31 Days story, you kind of talked about growing up with life with SMA. Can you just talk more about that and just, you know, anything general you want to discuss?
Okay. I'm 19 years old. I'm a student at the University of Louisville. I was diagnosed when I was a year old, and the doctor said to my parents just to take me home and like make me comfortable, and that I probably wouldn't make it past the age of two. So they were kind of like fed up with that. And he was like, just take her to Disney World or something. And this is kind of funny, like in our family, like we've been to Disney World every summer since like the doctor said that. So other than that, just growing up with SMA, I didn't feel any different until middle school. Elementary school, the kids didn't treat me any differently at all. They were actually like really helpful and like helped me out like without me even asking. And it was like I didn't even realize I had a disability or a difference for real until middle school. And that's partially because I used to be a cheerleader in elementary school, and like they were really accommodating in my elementary school. And then when I went to middle school, they were like, you can't cheerlead for us. You can't do this because you can't tumble and all that. And I was like, well, there's more to cheerleading than tumbling and all that. But I just began to feel ostracized, not just by the students, but also by like the staff and everything as well.
Yeah. And it's crazy how inclusion kind of changes, like depending on the environment and like, and yeah, and by the way, too, my family and I are huge Disney buffs as well. So like, you know, like we might be tied. I don't know, I've lost track of how many times I've been. We haven't done every single year, but we do a lot. And then my sister and brother-in-law definitely outnumber us all, but yeah. And this is something you wrote about in that story of kind of like, you know, you struggled with that rejection and lack of inclusion in middle school. And then it was around in high school, I believe, when you started to like want to try it again. And was there anything in particular that kind of gave you that confidence boost and wanted to make you try it?
I'll say that I surrounded myself with people that like I kind of like just went into my shell like sixth grade year after like I like was ostracized. Like I would invite people to my birthday parties and then they wouldn't invite me to theirs. Then I hear about it over the weekend, like that they hung out, and then that like they would be like, oh, I couldn't come to yours, but they hung out with other people. And there was just stuff like that. And I kind of fell like into a depression for about like up until my sophomore year of high school. And that was because one of my favorite teachers, Mrs. Robinson, she kind of like helped me get out of my shell, and I kind of started to like become myself again. Like I wasn't that same like bubbly open person until high school again. So yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a common journey for a lot of people, but especially in disabled communities, it's like, you know, when you experience that rejection, it's like natural to go. And that's great that you had that person to help you kind of like inspire you and get out of that kind of like shell, like you said. So,
she really helped me a lot. She was the teacher sponsor for Best Buddies. I was on the executive board of that during high school. So I feel like she really, and her daughter also had a disability. So she, I feel like she really was an ally to me, and she helped me, like, she helped me advocate a lot in high school because my high school was very inaccessible, and we can get into that later, but it was very inaccessible.
Oh, feel free to go on that. No, I, you know, I've had a guest on before who talked about how he and his sister both have SMA, and they both had to fight for the graduation to accommodate them because the ceremony wasn't set up well. So no, yeah, that, I think that this is something that's very important for public schools and colleges today. Like, what were some of the accessibility issues you had to fight and advocate for?
My high school was very big. It was like, I think 4,000 plus students, and there was four different floors. So we had to use the elevator, and the fourth floor, you couldn't like access with the elevator. You had to take the steps. And so I had a class up there one time, and then like, I couldn't go to the class because the elevator didn't go up there. So they had to change the classroom like to the third floor. And also like the elevator, you had to turn a key to like turn it on and call it down. But like, I can't physically do that. So I had to have like somebody do it for me. And they would, and I didn't have a key like myself. Like I could ask like one of my friends and say, hey, can you help me get down the elevator? But I couldn't, I had to wait till like one of the adults came with me. So I couldn't like just leave on my own or whenever like I wanted to. But they did give keys to like when students broke their legs, like they would give them the keys, but they wouldn't give the students in the wheelchairs keys. And they were supposed to give it back like after they were out of their cast and out of their crutches, but they never did. So they would just like be riding, they would hog the elevator while we would like, we who actually needed the elevator, they would be hogging it and just like playing around on it, and they wouldn't give the key back. But I had to fight, like I didn't get a key until my senior year of high school, but they gave the keys willingly to like students who were able-bodied and like just needed it for a month or two. And another like example of that would be like, this was when Miss Robinson, she helped me like advocate for myself, but there was, we always had like pep rallies. Like we had our rivalry, we had a rivalry that it's been going on for like hundreds of years. So for the pep rallies in the gym, there was like four big sections, and like freshmen would sit here, sophomores, juniors, seniors. So like each year you would move, and the seniors and the juniors were on like the bottom floor, but they wouldn't let us sit down there with them. Even though there was an elevator that goes down there, they would make us sit up there with the freshmen and sophomores, even when we were like juniors and seniors. So I had to like fight for that and say like, I want to be with my classmates. Like, I don't want to be up here with, I mean, nothing against freshmen and sophomores, but if like, it's kind of like a rite of passage, like to sit down there on the gym floor instead of up in like the balcony. So I had to fight for that, and I started fighting for it my junior year, but they wouldn't let me, like even though there was an elevator and all they had to do was put me on the elevator and press a button, they wouldn't let me until my senior year. So yeah,
and it's so wild. And I'm thinking like, so you said you went to a really large high school too. So like I went to a large magnet school, and like it was probably 2,000 plus, something like that. Not quite, but I'm curious, were there other wheelchair users in your class or at the school? Or like, because I, even at a big school, I was still about the only one in my class. There were like a handful here and there, but like, but it mainly my class. So did you kind of, I when you started advocating, did you kind of like align yourselves with other students in the same situation?
I did, but I feel like I was the one that cared about it the most, like I pushed for it the most. I feel like they were just kind of like, oh, I don't want to cause any trouble, or like, it's fine like this. But I was like, no, this isn't right. We should be like, we should have our own keys. We should be with our classmates. And yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool. And I mean, I think it speaks to, especially like when you're a teenager, like, you know, advocacy is something most aren't going to be thinking about that, but it's almost like people in our communities are kind of forced into it because, like, if we don't speak up, then nothing's going to change.
And I'll say that I really didn't start thinking about advocacy until like high school. And it was because of, I was a Muscular Dystrophy Association ambassador. So that kind of like helped me get into it. But then, like, now looking back into middle school and like seeing like some of the stuff like that wasn't right, like we would eat lunch, but they would have all like the disabled students sit together. Like we couldn't sit with any of the other like able-bodied students. And my brother went to the same middle school as me, and he doesn't have SMA or anything. I'm the only one in the family. So yeah. I would go, like, they had these rectangular tables that they would sit at, and like they had the benches that were all connected. I don't know if you've seen those before, but all I could do was sit on them. And they had the disabled students like sit at round tables, like all the way on the other side of the room. So I would go and like visit my brother sometimes, and they would be like, you need to get back to the other side of the room. And I'd be like, but that's my brother. Like, I just wanted some food from him or something. I didn't want to sit there with him. Like, he was younger than me anyways. I was like an eighth grader. I didn't want to be seen with a sixth grader for real, but I just wanted some food. But they wouldn't, like, we couldn't sit with our classmates, and they made us sit over there. So, yeah.
Oh, it's so messed up. I mean, it's not surprising entirely, but it's still like, it's one of those things people outside of our communities don't really comprehend the level of discrimination that still goes on. But that is why. Let me ask you, did you have an aide with you growing up in school?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah.
All throughout like elementary, middle, and high school. So it's kind of weird being in college now where I don't have an aide 24/7 like me, but I'm getting used to it now.
I was going to ask about that because, yeah, it was the same for me. I had, and I don't know, like, did you have the same one or did you go through different aides, like, throughout school?
It was different ones, yeah.
Yeah. No, same. I had one for the first couple years of elementary school, then another one. And then, so about, I think, like, 3 or 4 in elementary school, one in sixth grade. And then I did have the same one from, like, halfway through seventh grade to graduation. High school, which I'm like, I always say bless her because she had to meet me when I was at my most like awkward adolescent phase and I was super grumpy and stuff. So like it's impressive she stuck with me when I was 14. And I got better as I went along. But you bring up a great point that like so in talking about the transition to college, I think that's that was definitely one of the biggest things for me because my aide and I had the kind of relationship where, you know, she would still give me space and, you know, I would still get like, she'd go to lunch elsewhere, stuff like that. Or even if classes I didn't really need as much help with, she could go do her own thing during that time. But still, for the most part, I always had her with me, going to classes and all of that. So it was a big transition going to a university that was huge and I didn't have, you know, anyone with me. So what was that like for you? We'll talk about other aspects of college too, but what was that aspect for like for you of getting used to just going from class to class and not having one there with you all the time?
Now I just have like someone, they walk me to my class and like just make sure I get there okay. And I get my materials out and then that's pretty much it. But like in the high school, they used to sit in the class with me and like sit like beside me or behind me. And I remember like, this is kind of like a funny story that we have between my mom and I, but one day, like, I feel like they didn't give me a lot of independence in high school because they were like kind of hovering over me at like all times. So I just like, I didn't run away from them, but they said I did run away from them. And they like, I just wanted to be independent. So I would just like go off with my friends or something. And one of the aides like actually called my mom and was like, Gabrielle just ran away from me and all that. And my mom like laughs about that to this day because she knows that I just wanted to be independent and that I didn't really run away. But I feel like it's a different level of like independence and freedom than high school. Because I don't feel like they're hovering around me 24/7. And I feel more in control because I hire them, I'm their employer. Whereas the school was their employer, so they couldn't, like, leave me, per se, I guess. So, yeah.
Oh, it's absolutely a totally different dynamic. And like you said, I mean, it was a similar thing for me too. Of like once I got to college, like having that freedom, I mean, it was in some ways intimidating at first, but it was also really liberating because and I mean, when I started out at school, I kind of like I was terrible with directions and stuff and get around campus. So I needed friends to kind of like who knew where they were to help me around. But after that, like I mean, I think about, times like I mean, in the freshman year up where I would go across campus by myself, not any problem. I did have a service dog with me and stuff, but like, but yeah, like it, I mean, it was a really cool feeling, like not having to, depend on, so, still having people around you there when you need you, when you need them, but also having that, knowing that you could go where you want or, have time to yourself and all that. So that's really cool. But yeah, well, we'll get, I do want to talk a lot more about your college experience and the transition in just a minute. But before we do, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A treatment has been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this treatment option a reality. To learn more about this treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
Okay, so Gabrielle, backtracking just a little bit to the initial transition to college. Like, so you talked about how you kind of like broken out of your shell more toward the end of high school and gotten more involved in things. But like, what were back when you were a senior in high school, what were your thoughts about college? Like, did you know you wanted to live away from home? And what were those conversations like between you and your family?
I'm going to say there was a lot of turmoil and there was a lot of like, I don't want to say arguing, but my mom didn't want me to, I wanted to go to Murray State, which is 2 hours away. But my parents were like, I don't think you should. Just like with my childhood, I like grew up and then I was out of the hospital, like in and out of the hospital a lot. I got pneumonia a lot and all that. So they were just worried about that. And there was an instance when I got my hip resected. It's like permanently dislocated now. I almost died after that surgery because they wouldn't let my parents back there after the surgery to like position me, and they kept trying to straighten my legs out. So I was like screaming in pain and they just kept giving me more and more pain medicine. So then when they finally let my parents back there, they said that they gave me enough medicine for the both of them. So I went into like sepsis and everything. So that they're still like kind of traumatized for that. Like, they literally thought it was going to be my last days and like we were getting ready to say their goodbyes and everything. So I understand where they're coming from. Now I do. But at the time, I was just like, I want to be free. Like, I just want to be on my own. And I kind of am still feeling like that because my brother, I told you I have a younger brother.
Yes, yeah.
He's 17 now and he's like going through the college process and he's going to Tennessee State University, which is like 2 or 3 hours away. So I kind of feel like he's having the experience that I didn't get to have. Like, he gets to move away from home. And I mean, that's kind of, I really wanted to go to like California or something. Like, I wanted to move as far away as I can from Kentucky, but it didn't work out like that. And I'm okay with that right now. So,
yeah. No, and I think it's, I mean, you'll hear all kinds of stories in the community about like some parents are organizing, others like have that natural inclination to want to be protective, and it, like you said, it's totally understanding. But were there, once you did decide, like, I mean, because you're still away from home and you're on your own, like, what was that process like of, moving on to away from campus, getting caregiver set up, all of that?
The hardest part was the caregivers, and I'm still struggling with that a little bit. Like, just finding, not even just finding good ones, but keeping good ones as well. Like, and then like with the government pays them, but they don't really pay a lot, so that doesn't help them to stay. So then I have to pay some of it out of pocket, and my parents do too, because the government only pays $10 an hour. That's not enough to keep someone in this kind of job when there's like $18 an hour at the hospital nearby or something. So that was the hardest part for me, was I was interviewing all summer, like all last summer when I was preparing to move on campus. Like I had five interviews a day. Like I would wake up at 9 a.m. and like just be interviewing people all day. And that was the hardest part for me, was finding people and like knowing where to post my like job application and all of that, because I know some schools have that, like with the Disability Resource Center, but I reached out to my Disability Resource Center here and they were like, you're on your own basically. So that it was hard to find like where I can find people at.
It's definitely a struggle for a lot of, and I mean, as someone who's like 28, and it's, yeah, mm-hmm. it's always an ongoing struggle. And like you said, for those exact reasons. And I know with colleges, it's like, yeah, like my university, the Disability Service Office was really helpful for anything classroom related. And like, they provided note takers with me, which is extremely helpful, but same thing, they weren't responsible for, you know, helping disabled students live on campus and our caregivers, all that. So that's a whole another ball game, but do you remember kind of the thoughts you had going into that? Cause did you have any caregivers growing up beyond your parents, or was this your first time?
I did. My one caregiver in high school, my mom paid for her. Like she worked at the high school I went to. And then like, she would work for my mom, like after like hours after I was out of like school. So from like two, when I got out of school, to eight, she would just be with me. And that was pretty much the only one I had before. And I had like a couple, like when I was a kid, through the government, like they provided them through the government, but that's pretty much all I remember.
Okay. Yeah. So so then this was your first time kind of like finding them on your own and doing the interview process. Was there like, I mean, it's always anxiety inducing going into the, and like trying to find the people, but like, is there anything you've learned about the process of it, or what questions to ask and what you look for in people?
That's a good question. That's kind of hard. I think I've learned that you should never like stop interviewing, because I thought I was good. Like I had all the shifts covered. I had backups and everything. But then like my main shift, like she had like a mental breakdown, and so she couldn't work anymore. So then I'm kind of like just stuck, because most of my employees are like students. They're my age, except for like the main shift that I have, which is from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. because most people have classes during that time. But she couldn't do that time, and then I couldn't find anybody else to do that time. So that was the hardest part for me, was trying to find somebody else. So I think what I learned is like to just keep interviewing, even if you think you have like everything covered.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and like there's some candidates that you think might work out really well, but then a better one comes along, or it's good to have backups, all those things come into play. But that's awesome. And then looking at your school life, so you're majoring in psychology and you got a double minor. Do you know, I mean, I know every college student gets asked this, but like, do you know what you want to do, or what kind of sparked your interest in that major?
This is kind of a long story.
Go ahead.
But out of high school, like senior year, I was in choir like all through middle school and high school. So I always wanted to pursue music at first. And senior year, a music therapist came in our choir class and he talked to me. So that's what I applied to U of L for, was for music therapy. But that was not the most accessible major. So I ended up switching my major to psychology, which I liked at first. But music therapy I really loved it. But my guitar professor, he wasn't like very accommodating. I couldn't like press down on the strings as hard as you have to do to play the guitar. I could play the piano, I could play the ukulele, but the guitar was the only thing And it was a lot of arguing and fighting, like not fighting, but like over email, just like kind of nice, nasty emails. Like he was like, "You need to prove to me that you can't play it." And I'm like, "You literally see me right here. Like I can't, like no sound is coming out of the guitar because I can't play it." And he was the, I went to the department head of music therapy and she let me borrow a cue cord, which is like a digital guitar. So all you have to do is like swipe on the like tablet to play it. And he wouldn't let me play that for his class. He said I had to play an acoustic guitar because it said in the syllabus that I had to play that. And it was his class. So I was like, okay, well, if I want to be a board certified music therapist, I don't have to play the, like I pulled up the like board certified test and was like, I don't have to play it for the test. So why do I have to play it for your class? And he just wouldn't let me. He even ordered a guitar that was like small. I went to the smallest size guitar and it still didn't work. And it was just a lot of back and forth and arguing. So I kind of got tired of like doing that. And I didn't really know if I wanted to do music therapy, especially after going through that. And just, I could see that the curriculum and that the profession itself was like catered towards able-bodied people more, even though when you're a music therapist, you treat disabled kids and disabled people. I could tell this through like the able-bodied lens that they did it. So that's why I switched to psychology. I love psychology. Absolutely love it now. I took AP Psych my junior year. So that's what I originally wanted to do until I found music therapy. But I like psychology now. And I want to open my own clinic one day for people who are disproportionately underserved in mental health and hopefully get my doctorate of psychology one day.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it's crazy because I've had other guests on the show talk about switching majors also because of ableism experiences. And it's, you know, it's a really unfortunate thing, but I'm glad in your situation, it's led to something I think better. And like, you know, that sounds like a really cool career path, but yeah, it's why, like I said, the discrimination that is still very prevalent across, you know, education. That's something that will hopefully change, but definitely. So also backtracking a little to your family life. So you said, okay, so you have a younger brother. Is that your only sibling?
Yes, he
is. Okay. So can you talk just about kind of like growing up with your family, family dynamics and you know, how SMA comes into play there, but just in general, your relationship there with your brother and your parents?
My brother, he's really helpful at times. Like I know that being a sibling of a person with a disability, like they kind of have to sacrifice, and like he helps me a lot. So he drives me around. Like if I ask him to drive me around, he'll drive me around, and he'll, most of the time he'll do stuff for me. Sometimes he won't. Like I'll say, "Can you give me some water?" He'll be like, "No," but other times he's pretty good brother. Growing up, we always had like a good connection and everything, and I always feel kind of like bad that he had to kind of take care of me when he was like still growing up. But otherwise, yeah. And my parents, I love my parents. Both of my parents, they're divorced, but they both got remarried. So I didn't really get to grow up with a two-parent household, but I'm still very close to them.
That's awesome. That's awesome. No, what you said about your brother there, like sometimes like denying it. So I got to make fun of my brother for this at his wedding, but like I'm the youngest of three, neither of my siblings have SMA, and both are extremely helpful and we always had a relationship, but like especially when we were kids, like if my brother was on the couch and he didn't want to get up to help me, like he would, like if I dropped a toy or something, he, instead of getting up, he'd pick it up with his foot and then fling it at me. So I made fun of him at his wedding for that, but yeah. I think it's, you're totally right though. It is a like different dynamic when for siblings who have siblings with disabilities, but in some ways it actually enhances the relationship, I think. Like
I think
that's really cool. And then one other thing I was going to ask you is, so like, I noticed you're like, you're really active on social media and you built a presence there. And this is something that I feel like really in that just in the past few years, like even when I was in college, it wasn't like there, you didn't see a ton of disability activists on Instagram or Twitter or anything. And that's become more prevalent in the last few years. So was there anything that kind of prompted you to want to start sharing more of your life and about SMA on social media?
I just kind of started doing it. I don't think there was really any, like, it didn't start out like that. Like, I just wanted, I didn't have an Instagram. Well, I did. I had an Instagram in seventh grade, but I had it, like, I wasn't allowed to have it. So then I got, like, suspended off. My mom took it away from me and all that. So then, like, when I was finally allowed to have it again, I just wanted to, like, kind of share. I feel like I missed out since, like, everybody had it through, like, high school and all that, and I didn't have it. So I kind of wanted to share, like, about my life and all that. And then I found, like, other people, and I was like, I could do more of this, like, activism on social media. I never thought about it before, though.
Yeah. No, it's a really powerful tool, I think, for, I mean, yeah, like, it's something I've written about. I know. Yeah, social media can get a bad rap and there are certainly negatives to it. But I think for people in our communities and in other minorities, like, it's given us a platform to really share our stories and make the world more aware of the things we deal with. So that's really cool. But yeah, that's awesome. And so one thing I always ask to guests is, like, just to kind of walk us through a day in the life of you. So, you know, I mean, especially, I mean, I know you started out college virtually because during the pandemic, but now that you're on campus, everything, can you kind of, like, you know, just give listeners a glimpse of, like, what a typical day of the week looks like for you?
I wake up, wash my face, brush my teeth, take a shower, all that, go to class. It really depends on, like, I'm in a sorority. I don't know if I told you that before.
Oh, but, feel free to talk about that. Yeah.
I love my sorority. My mom was a part of the sorority. She's a part of the sorority as well. So I'm a legacy. Awesome. And I wake up, and it depends on if we have an event for the sorority or anything, or if there's any, I'm involved in a lot of other, like, clubs on campus too. So if there's an event for that, I go to that, get some food, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. No, it was similar. I didn't do fraternity life, but I was, like, heavily involved in a lot of organizations too. So, like, what are some of the other, so you do the sorority, and then, like, what are some of the other organizations you're involved with in campus life?
I'm in My Sister's Keeper, which is a Black Women's Health Imperative movement, Black Student Union, the Mental Health and Physical Health Committee, like, for the University of Louisville. And there's literally so much. I forget some sometimes, but I think that's it. Yeah.
I remember you were saying before we started recording that you're kind of, like, trying to make up for lost time because, you know, like, ending high school with the pandemic. Yeah.
But I think my sorority takes up most of my time.
Like, sure. Yeah. Sure. That's great, though. That's awesome. And also, I want to ask, so are you on any SMA treatments, or have you?
Yes, I am. I've been on pretty much almost all of them except for Zolgens. I've been on Evrysdi, and I was on Spinraza for 2 years, I think.
Gotcha. And you're on Evrysdi now?
Yes.
Gotcha. Yes. And what is kind of the experience then been with both, like, and have you experienced any gains or changes since starting treatment?
I feel like I gained more with Spinraza just because it was, like, literally getting injected into my body, whereas I take the Evrysdi orally, so I feel like it doesn't, I mean, it's still, I can tell a difference, but it's I'd rather take that every day than get, like, injected in my spine every so often. They had to put me to sleep, like, every time they inject. I mean, the first time I got it, I was not asleep, and I was like, never again. Like, I could feel the needle go in my back. I could feel them take the spinal fluid out. I could feel the fluid, like, the Spinraza go in when it rushed in my spine. Like, it was just not a good experience that first time. So after that, they put me to sleep like every time. And my spine was fused and they didn't like know where they could like go into my spine it because my spine is fused. So the first time they had to like poke me like 3 or 4 times just to draw some spinal fluid out. So that was very painful. But otherwise, it was a good experience. I told you I had to get put to sleep. That was the only part like they were worried about because of my neurologist was worried about that because of my asthma and all that, like being put to sleep too much that can like affect my lungs and everything. But I've noticed like some gains, like I can, like a soy sauce packet, I couldn't like rip it like that before, but now I can. And I can open like jars, like I couldn't grip the jar like that before, but now I can grip it. And yeah, I've noticed a lot of gains.
That's really cool. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I've only been on Spinraza and like, and yeah, I just kind of got used to it, but it is obviously way more invasive, but yeah. No, for me too, it was like, it was that, that first time was the most anxiety inducing and it was just getting over that. And then once I got used to the process, it was better, but it's definitely. Well, and Gabrielle, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on, but last question. Oh, absolutely. And last question is just, is there any kind of message or advice you want to share with others in the SMA community, you know, based on your experiences or just anything you want to share?
I think I would just say to find others in the community because that's really helped me a lot, like go through my journey as a person with SMA, especially during college, because I had no idea what to start with or how to like do anything to get to college. Like as far as like managing my care and all that, I didn't know what to do. So I reached out to people in the community and they really helped me and they still are helping me. So that would be my advice.
That's awesome. No, I totally support that. I think it's, it was similar to me too when I was like toward the end of high school, I realized that I needed to really reconnect and establish more relationships with people in the community because it was so essential for going into college and adult life. So yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. And also what is your Instagram handle or anywhere else people can find you?
It's Gab period Davetta. So G-A-B period D-A-V-E-T-T-A.
Awesome. We'll definitely put that in the episode description, but yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, Gabrielle, thank you again so much. This was fantastic. And best of luck, too, with the rest of college. And yeah, awesome. Well, for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly in our forums and follow us on smanewstoday.com for all the latest news and perspectives regarding SMA. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.